blessings to the reading of his word. My father was 42 years old when he immigrated from Korea to the United States. And so it should be no surprise that he had a thick Korean accent. In fact, when I look back, I'm surprised that he even learned how to speak English at all. My dad worked insanely long hours. He cared for his family. He volunteered at church. When in the world did he have time to learn English? I don't know. Somehow he learned it. He learned how to speak. He learned how to be conversant. But he had a really, really thick accent. And his accent was especially fun when we went out to eat at very nice restaurants, because my dad had a favorite dish that he loved to order at nice restaurants. Whenever we went to a restaurant, the first thing he would do is he would open the menu and look to see if they had this item. And when the server came around, he would ask for what he called the filet mingo. And the server would usually ask, "Well, I'm sorry, can you repeat that, please?" And he would say, "Give me the filet mingo." And it would go on for a while. And then eventually the server would have to say, "I'm sorry, sir, we don't serve flamingos in our restaurant." And at this point, I usually let it go on for a little bit. And then I'd have to interject and explain, my dad wants to order filet mignon. My dad was an immigrant. And as an immigrant, he often felt misunderstood. And he often misunderstood other people, and he often felt out of place. Over 25 years ago, my dad and my uncle did something amazing. He was an American citizen who didn't feel like an American, and yet, like so many immigrants, he contributed more than he knew to his adopted country. Over 25 years ago, my dad and my uncle opened a business in the San Francisco Mission District, which at that time was a very impoverished and crime-ridden area. This is before the gentrification. This is before the hipsterification of the Mission District, before it became a cool and safe place to do business. My dad and my uncle opened a business in the Mission District. Last Saturday, I was meeting a friend in the Mission. Completely different place, completely different, you know, group of people hanging out, and we were eating at a taqueria, a place that I love to go to with my dad, and I talked to the owner. I had to talk to the owner because it was the same owner that was there 25 years ago. And I told her, I used to come here when I was 12 years old with my dad. Do you remember him? He used to own the video store down the block, and she actually remembered him. The business that had been out of business, it's been out of business for several years now, and yet his presence made a lasting mark in the community. The Bible uses this metaphor of the immigrant, this metaphor of the exile, as a metaphor for the life of a believer. And if you believe in Jesus, if you are someone who is believing and following Jesus, chances are you have felt out of place in your life. You know what it feels like to be out of place. Your beliefs are out of place. Your values are out of place. Your lifestyle sometimes just feels out of place. You feel misunderstood by people, by the media, by friends, by relatives, by coworkers, and sometimes you misunderstand other people. If you're figuring out what it means to believe in Jesus, if you're figuring out what it means to follow Jesus, Christians may seem alien to you. Christians may feel foreign to you. You don't get some of the things that Christians do. You don't understand why we pray. You don't understand completely why we sing during worship. You don't understand the way that Christians talk. You're not sure how anybody could organize their life around a belief in God or a belief in Jesus. More specifically, however we find ourselves today, whether we are here believing or seeking belief, I think it's safe to say that none of us like to feel out of place. That's a place of discomfort for all of us. We don't think of displacement as a blessing. If the United States today told you and your family that you were going to be deported and that you could never return to the United States, your first reaction probably would not be, what a blessing. We don't like displacement. We like to know and believe that we have a place in this world, that we've made a place for ourselves. We spend our energy trying to find our place in this world, not trying to find displacement. And yet, as we study this book, the book of Daniel, what we're going to find is something counterintuitive, that displacement is a blessing. We are going to learn about the blessedness of displacement. And there are some of you here today that are feeling that displacement. You know, you've just moved into a new neighborhood. You've moved into a new house. You've just started a new job. You're looking for a new job. You're thinking about getting out of your job. You're still trying to make and find your place in this world. And if that's you, there's incredible hope. Because our culture says that the blessed life, the happy life, is for those who have made their mark, who've made a place for themselves in this world. And yet, what the Bible consistently teaches us, and will teach us forcefully through the story of Daniel, through the book of Daniel, is that there is blessedness in displacement. So we're going to find this particularly in chapter 1, and we're going to see this in 3 points. First, we're going to look at how we have been displaced by God. Second, we're going to look at how we have been displaced with God. And then finally, we're going to look at how we've been displaced for the world. Displaced by God, displaced with God, and displaced for the world. So first, we've been displaced by God. And it's very clear at the very beginning of our passage. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave what? The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both royal family and of the nobility, youths, without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace. So what do we learn? We learn that God gave all these things to the Babylonians. Why is Daniel living in Babylon? Well, it's because God gave Daniel to the Babylonians. Why are Israelites, what are people from the tribe of Judah doing in Babylon? God gave them over. What are the holy artifacts from the temple in Jerusalem doing in the temple of the false gods of Babylon? God gave them to the Babylonians. There's a stark picture of displacement here. The people of God to this point belong in Judah, in Israel, in Jerusalem. And yet they have been displaced. They are in a place that they don't belong. They are in Babylon. If you look at one of our reflection quotes at the front of our worship programs today, there's a quote from Psalm 137. It's a very simple one, just simple verse, written during the exile in Babylon. And it reads this way: "By the waters of Babylon, there we sat and wept when we remembered Zion." In this beautiful and yet tragic poetry, the Bible shows us what every Israelite felt during this period in biblical history. They felt like crying. Their hearts were broken. The exile didn't feel like a blessing. It felt like a curse. And there's two reasons that the exile felt like a curse. On one level, the exile felt like a curse because the Bible actually said it was a curse. Back in Deuteronomy chapter 28, in the law of God, God told his people, if you do not keep my law, then I am going to bring foreign nations against you. Right? This is what it says in Deuteronomy 28, verse 64. And the Lord will scatter you among all peoples from one end of the earth to the other, and there you shall serve other gods of wood and stone, which neither you nor your fathers have known. This was a tragic stroke of God's judgment. The reason why the people of God were in exile, the reason why they were displaced, was because they didn't obey God, because they didn't keep God's law. And it sounds like harsh punishment. At this point, Daniel and his friends are teenagers. They're very, very young, maybe 13, 14, 15 years old at most. And they're taken away from their families. They're taken away from their homeland. They're taken away from their religion and taken to Babylon. And there's no questioning that they felt abandoned by God. The Psalms speak so powerfully to us. It was heart-wrenching. And as if the trauma of captivity was not enough, Nebuchadnezzar tried to destroy their faith. He tried to turn these Israelites into Babylonians. This happened to my dad and my grandmother when they were growing up in Korea, before the Korean War, when Korea was a colony of Japan. My dad was given a Japanese name. My grandmother was given a Japanese name. And they were taught Japanese in their schools in Korea. And they were not permitted to speak Korean in their schools. It was a forced assimilation. And this is what's happening to Daniel and to his friends. They're put into a Babylonian university. And what are they learning in this Babylonian university? They're learning Babylonian literature, Babylonian language, Babylonian religion. And then he changes their names. Their names are changed. Daniel means God is my judge. What an incredibly biblical and theologically rich name. His name is changed to Belshazzar, after the Babylonian god Bel, which means Bel, protect me. Right? There is no subtlety here. The goal is to turn these Israelites into Babylonians, to change their faith, to change their religion. Daniel's three friends are also given new names, named after Babylonian gods. And God allowed all of this to happen to them. God gave them to the Babylonians. They were displaced by God. Now, some of you are feeling displaced. And as you look at the displacement in your lives, whatever that displacement looks like, you're new to an area, you are feeling the pressure to move out of the area, whatever in your life does not seem to fit, it's easy to feel like you're failing in life, isn't it? It's easy to feel like God has abandoned you. It's easy to feel like God is punishing you. If you've recently lost someone that you love, if you've lost a job, if you've lost a home, if you feel like you're failing in life, you're going to be tempted to think that God has abandoned you, that God is punishing you, that you did something wrong. And you may be wondering, what am I supposed to do? How do I get out of this? What do I need to do differently? You see, the thing is that when we are displaced by God, we think that we are displaced by God as punishment. We think that God has displaced us because he hates us. But what if? What if God actually displaces us as an expression of his love? What if punishment is only one layer and the surface layer at that? What if beneath the surface there are other reasons motivating God, other goals, other purposes? What if God's ultimate purpose in our displacement is not to punish us, but to bless us? And so this brings us to our second point, that we are displaced with God. We're not only displaced by God, but we are displaced with God. Some of you guys know that I like to watch Gordon Ramsay. It's a guilty pleasure, but I love just... I get excited listening to him rant with his British accent and bully people. I know it's not nice to watch people getting bullied, but sometimes it's fun. Last week, you know, you may, if you're not a fan, you may not know, he just started a new show called Hotel Hell. You know, he has kitchen nightmares, he has Hell's Kitchen, and this new show is called Hotel Hell. And in this new reality show, what Gordon Ramsay does is he goes around to failing hotels and he coaches them to try to get them back into a more financially healthy position. And he was at one particular hotel on the East Coast. And what Gordon decided to do to get through with an owner that he was not getting through to, he locked him up in a room in his own hotel, and it was on the third floor of the hotel, the entire floor was closed off to guests. And the reason why it was closed off is because this floor had, you know, it was completely run down. It was dirty and moldy. There were walls that were with holes in them, you know, the roof was falling down, it was decrepit, okay? And he decided to lock the owner into one of the rooms, and he told them, I want you to just sit here and think about your future, because if you don't change what you see around you, that's your future, right? That's what Gordon Ramsay did. Now, the fact is, when we read the book of Daniel, when we read about the exile, when we think about displacement, what do we think? We think God has locked us in a room, and he's telling us, if you don't shape up, this is your future. If you don't shape up, this is what's going to happen to you. You better change. And when we look at Daniel, and we look at him and his friends in the exile, what we think is, those guys got the message. We should be like them. We should dare to be a Daniel. We should look at our future, be afraid, be very afraid, and get motivated to get right with God. But when we look closely at the book of Daniel, what we're going to find is a dramatically different message. God is no Gordon Ramsay. God does not lock us in a dark room and tell us, think about your future, you better shape up. Look at verse 9. Remember, in verse 2, we saw that God gave the people of Judah over to Babylon. What does it say in verse 9? It says, God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. That compassion, that favor, and the Hebrew word for favor there is a very special and unique Hebrew word, chesed, which means so much more than just favor. It means covenant faithfulness, right? It means grace. It means lifelong commitment. God, that favor, that compassion that Daniel experiences from the chief eunuchs isn't really coming from the chief eunuchs. It's coming from God. In verse 17, what does it say? It says, as for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. Where did the learning and skill come from? It didn't come from their intelligence. It didn't come from their discipline and hard work. It came from God. God gave them these things. Finally, if you look at verse 21, it says, Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. This is basically a preview of the entire book of Daniel, because King Cyrus is the last king in Daniel's life. And he is not only the last king in Daniel's life, he's the first king that makes the decree that leads to the return of the Jewish people to Israel, right, to Jerusalem. Cyrus is the king that ends the beginning of the end of the exile for the people of God. And this is a 70-year span here in verse 21. 70 years from the time that Daniel first comes to Babylon to the time that he dies in Babylon. And what we get a picture of here, God gives compassion and grace to Daniel. God gives wisdom and understanding and success to Daniel and his friends. And he keeps Daniel and guards him until Cyrus, until that time when exile is over. What does this all show us? It shows us that God is with Daniel and his friends. God is with his people in exile. And what that means is that God is in exile. Have you ever, parents, you ever give your kids time out? Usually when I give them time out, I will put them in their timeout area and leave. But occasionally when they're particularly distressed, I will have to stay with them. Right? And I stay with them through their timeout. And what happens by default is that I'm in timeout, right? I'm not able to do the things that I want. Maybe I was watching a baseball game on TV and I'm interrupted, but I'm in timeout with my child. And this is the picture of God. God is in exile with his people. It's not as if he locked them in a room and told them, you're not getting out until you learn your lesson. God is with his people being punished, exiled together with them. When we look at the life of Daniel, it's easy to look at his life as an example or a model to follow. But this is not the way that Daniel sees himself. In fact, when we finish reading about the life of Daniel, start reading about the visions, and this is one of the reasons why it's so important to read the last six chapters of Daniel together with the first six chapters of Daniel. Because in the last six chapters of Daniel, there is no way that you can say that Daniel is the hero of the book of Daniel. Who is the hero of the book of Daniel? When you read the last six chapters, it's the Ancient of Days. It's the Son of Man who comes riding on the clouds. The hero of the book of Daniel is Jesus, the God in exile, the God who leaves heaven to be punished not only with his people, but instead of his people. The God who cuts himself off, the real hero of the book of Daniel, the real hero of all of our lives, is Jesus. Jesus is the ultimate exile. Another quotation in our worship program today comes from a sermon called The Restoration of the Banished by Horatius Bonar. And it reads this way. He spares not his son, but sends him in quest of exiles. He comes into the land of banishment, lies in an exile's cradle, becomes a banished man for them, lives a banished life, endures an exile's shame, dies an exile's death, is buried in an exile's tomb. He takes our place of banishment that we may take his place of honor and glory in the home of his Father and our Father. Friends, Christianity does not say that we need to get ourselves out of exile. Christianity says that God has exiled himself to deliver us from exile. We do not have a God that locks us in a room, but a God who comes to get us. This is the God that we worship. A God who is not a model for us or a coach, but a God who is a savior. A God who is a shepherd, who is willing to lay his life down for his sheep. This is how we can make sense of what Daniel does in this passage. Daniel refuses to eat the king's food. As part of the training to serve the king said that all the food that Daniel and his friends and all these people who are in the school of Babylon to become leaders in Babylon, that they would eat from the king's own table. And Daniel decides to abstain, right? It says in verse 8, Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food. Why did Daniel do this? Well, if Christianity is true, and if Jesus is in exile, one thing we know for sure is that Daniel did not do this because he was afraid of the exile. Daniel didn't refuse to eat the food because he learned his lesson. He didn't do it because he was afraid of punishment. He didn't do it because he was afraid of God. He didn't do it to try to become a good person. He did it as a response to God's grace, as a response to God's mercy, to a response to God's compassion. There's a lot of disagreement about this passage. It sounds really simple, but this is actually one of the more controversial passages in this chapter. Theologians really have vigorous disagreements about why Daniel didn't eat the food. Some people say Daniel didn't eat the food because it was against the dietary laws of the Old Testament. But that doesn't really work, does it? Because Daniel not only refused to eat meat, there are certain kinds of meat that kosher that are not kosher, but he also refused to drink wine. And wine is kosher, right? Wine is kosher. There was no reason for Daniel to refuse the wine. Some people say that Daniel refused to eat the meat and drink the wine because it was once offered to gods, to false gods, before it came to them, which was commonly done in that culture. But if you read Daniel chapter 10, there's a suggestion that Daniel eventually started eating the meat and drinking the wine. That doesn't really work either. I think there's a reason that this is subtle. There's a reason that it's not clear. And the reason it's not clear is because it's not supposed to be clear. We shouldn't get hung up on why Daniel refused to eat the king's meat and wine. Because if that's what we're worried about, we're missing the point. What is the point here? The point is not that Daniel kept some rule book. The point is that he wanted to be pure, that he wanted to abstain from defiling himself. He resolved not to defile himself. He wanted to keep himself pure. He wanted to devote himself fully to God. You see, this passage makes more sense if we see that this is not a black and white issue. What if there's nothing evil about the king's meat and the king's wine? What if it's not black and white? What if what motivated Daniel was not the law, but grace? You see, the law will make us afraid of breaking rules, but it cannot inspire us to do what is right above and beyond the call of duty. And yet grace, love, the compulsion of being loved will drive you to do something that you don't have to do. And that is what Daniel is doing here. He is showing unusual devotion to God. What Daniel is doing by refusing to eat the king's meat and drink the king's wine is he is making a statement. He is saying, you have changed my name to Belshazzar, but you cannot make me into Belshazzar. Bel is not my protector. God is my judge. I am Daniel, and I will trust God. I will trust in his grace. I will trust in his compassion. I will trust that he is with me in my exile, and he is watching over me, and he defines me. You do not define me. This brings us to our last point today, that we are displaced for the world, for Babylon in the story of Daniel, for us, for the Bay Area. Right? We are displaced for another purpose. We are displaced by God, we are displaced with God, and we're displaced for the world. Notice that Daniel's full-hearted devotion to God doesn't make him into a weirdo. It doesn't turn him into a jerk. It doesn't turn him into a snob. Daniel does not act like any of those stereotypes that we have about Christians in our culture. Daniel doesn't shove his faith down other people's throats. He doesn't quote the Bible to them and pressure them to adopt his values. He asks the steward of the chief of the eunuchs for permission to eat water and vegetables. And what answer does he get? The answer he gets is no. What does Daniel do? He doesn't pull out the persecuted victim card. I'm such a persecuted Christian. It sucks that I live in such a pagan world. Too bad that no one is as holy as I am. That's not what he does. What does he do? He graciously, humbly, selflessly listens, because the steward of the chief of unit actually doesn't care so much about preventing Daniel from worshiping his God. What is he really worried about? He's worried about his own head, right? He says, Daniel, if I let you do this and you get sick, something happens to you, you get weak, I'm going to get executed. My head is on the chopping block, right? Hey, I respect you and I love you, but not that much. And so Daniel listens, and what does he do? He offers a compromise. He offers another request. He adjusts his request. He says, give me a 10-day trial. 10-day trial. Let me drink water and eat vegetables. And in those 10 days, if I get sick, if I feel weak, if I'm not able to fulfill my duties, then I'll eat your food. I'll eat the king's food. But if not, let me continue. Daniel and his friends had an appreciation for their neighbors. They cared about their neighbors. And this is a tremendous thing, because Babylon, you know, a lot of Christians talk about the West Coast and about the Bay Area particularly as a very evil and wicked and godless place. But the Bay Area is nothing compared to Babylon. This is a culture where child sacrifice was normal. This was a culture that was violent. This was a culture that was corrupt. This was a culture that was bloodthirsty. And yet, even in this evil and corrupt and sometimes tyrannical culture, Daniel and his friends had an appreciation and love for the Babylonians. In fact, the Bible says that Daniel and his friends studied the Babylonian culture and religion, and when they studied it, they didn't just coast by, they didn't just pass, they excelled. They were better in their studies than all of their peers. They were better, it says, than anyone in the entire kingdom of Babylon. Look closely to what the Bible says. It says that they were better than all the magicians. They were better than all the enchanters in the kingdom. Daniel didn't believe in magic, but he understood Babylonian magic better than the Babylonian magicians. He didn't believe in fortune telling or enchantment, but he understood enchantment better than the enchanters and diviners and fortune tellers. Daniel didn't support everything there was to support in the Babylonian culture, but in a way, Daniel understood Babylonian culture better than the Babylonians. Let's put it another way. He understood agnosticism better than the agnostics. He understood atheism better than the atheists. He understood polytheism better than the polytheists, because he loved his neighbors. And not only because he loved his neighbors, the fact that he was so devoted to God gave him a unique perspective. You see, Babylon ultimately didn't belong to Babylon. Babylonian culture ultimately belonged to God. And so the Bible says again that it was God who gave them learning, God who gave them skill, God who gave them understanding in all the things of Babylonian culture. This is really important for us to understand, because what does it mean to be a Christian in the Bay Area? What does it look like to live a faithful Christian life in the Bay Area? Should we be afraid of the people around us? Should we step back from the people around us? Should we try not to get too involved? Well, no. Because if you look at the life of Daniel, what you find, and not only in the life of Daniel, but throughout the Bible, during this period of exile, in the story of Esther, in other passages as well, you find how God is using his people as witnesses to his kingdom, as witnesses to the gospel. And the fact that Daniel believed in God and not in Babylon gave him an advantage over Babylonians. If you ask a fish to describe water, it will say, presuming that the fish can talk, "What's water? What's water?" Right? The fact that Daniel and his friends were not swimming in the waters of Babylon, that they were not depending on Babylonian culture, that they had an identity outside of Babylon, that their identity was in God, gave them the ability, the unique ability, to understand Babylonian culture better than the Babylonians. You see, there is a heavenly Babylonian culture free from all the corruption, free from the violence, free from the insecurity, free from the oppression, free from the godlessness that it had become. Last reflection quote that we're going to look at today from our program is from C.S. Lewis. It's on page 3 of your worship programs. Prosperity knits a man to the world. He feels that he is finding his place in it, while really it is finding its place in him. This is the problem with our culture. This is the problem with being too comfortable in the world that we live in. We think that we are making a place for ourselves, but in reality, the world is finding a place in us. Daniel and his friends were able to master the culture because they were not mastered by the culture. They were set free because their identity was not in their success. Their identity was not in their learning. Their identity was in the God who loved them, the God who was with them in exile, the God who is gracious, because their identity was in Jesus. We'll close with a story from Tim Keller. Tim Keller tells a story of a woman who visited his church in Manhattan. One Sunday after worship, she came up to talk to him, and it was her first time visiting church. And so he talked to her and asked her why she chose this Sunday and why Redeemer, why she decided to come to Redeemer on this Sunday. And she told him a story about how recently she was certain that she was going to get fired because she had just started a new job, and she had made a critical mistake, a stupid rookie mistake that was going to cost her company a lot of money. And she was just bracing herself, preparing herself to be let go, but she wasn't let go. And when she talked to her boss and asked her what happened, you know, this is the kind of mistake that gets people fired. Why didn't I get fired? Her boss told her, well, I covered for you. And she said, why did you do that? Why did you cover for me? And he told her, well, you know, I've been working for a while, and I have the reputation, I have the credibility, I could take a hit like this, it won't hurt me too bad. If you take responsibility for this, it'll destroy you. It's not a big deal. She wasn't satisfied. She said, this is Manhattan. People do not do things like this in this town. Why did you do this for me? And so he went on to tell her, I wasn't really going to bring this up, but hey, I'm a Christian. And you know, I really believe that I have an identity outside of my success. And I believe that God's going to take care of me. And you know, I believe that because I've received so much that I should give to others. And her next question was, what church do you go to? And that's why she ended up at Redeemer that day. There is a Bay Area culture that people of the Bay Area have yet to know. A heavenly Bay Area culture. A less materialistic Bay Area culture. A less politically divided Bay Area culture. A more cohesively united and truth-loving Bay Area culture. A more generous and gracious Bay Area culture. A Bay Area culture dependent on God. A heavenly Bay Area culture, a culture that those who have been set free by Jesus, who understand that they are in exile with Jesus, are able to understand and see and recognize. And God is calling those of us who believe and follow Jesus to go out and be displaced. He's put us here, and he's put us here not to punish us. He's put us here for our good. He's put us here so that we could understand the depths of his love for us, the depths of his mercy, the depths of his grace. And he's put us here for the good of our neighbors, for the good of the Bay Area. For those of you who are on the fence, exploring the Christian faith, wondering what it means to live the Christian life, feeling the alienness of Jesus, how much more alien is your life apart from Jesus? How at home are you really in this world? And what difference would it make if you knew that your place in this world did not depend on you, but it depended on a God who made you and who loves you, who is able and willing to enter into your pain and sin and failure and bring you out of it. Let's pray.